So, first of all, what does it mean to be Catholic and not Roman Catholic? And that is what alarmed and set off the email, you know, response. What does it mean to be Catholic but not Roman Catholic? Well, I would say that I'm using Catholic as an adjective, not as a noun, okay? As a noun, in English, Catholic means that you're a Roman Catholic. But if I say that I'm Catholic, and you know, it is taking advantage of the English language, it's to precipitate them to ask, what's the difference? So what does it mean when I say that, okay? Well, first of all, let's just go through the dictionary. This is Catholic in the dictionary. You notice that there's an adjective form and a noun form. Adjective is a wide variety of things all embracing. The synonyms are universal, diverse, diversified, wide, broad, broad-based, eclectic, liberal, latitudinarian, narrow. What I'm talking about is this. Catholic, in its truest sense, just like other English words, like affair used to mean your business. Now it means something different nowadays. It's kind of a euphemism for adultery. Gay used to be, in all the Christmas carols, a happy gay time. Now it's a euphemism for sexual degeneracy. Okay, do you understand that words change with cultural, you know, context? And so when I say that, I'm taking advantage of the original meaning of the word Catholic, which is the universal, relating to the historic doctrine and practice of the Western Church and what characterizes all Christians. And, of course, the dictionary says it's of the Roman Catholic faith, but I'll show you why I say this. Now, the noun form is what you think it is. It's a Roman Catholic. Now, going back to where the word comes from, the word Catholic in English comes from, look at this, kata holos. Greek words that mean katholikos, universal. So actually, I'm thinking of the New Testament world and the church that came out of the day of Pentecost, and there was only one church that was born on the day of Pentecost. Today, there are hundreds of flavors of Christianity. And there's a lot of people that think Mormonism is Christianity, or they think, you know, some of these, let's all get together against abortion. They, under the umbrella of Christianity, they'll put almost anybody as long as they're pro-life or pro-family or something like that. And so what we've done is we've kind of lost the definitiveness of doctrine through wanting to have social power or something like that. So in the most basic sense in the Greek language, kata holos or katholikos means universal. And so that became in Latin Catholicus, which became Catholic in English. So that's what I'm talking about. But I only say it to cause that questioning. Because what it does is when I say I'm Catholic and not Roman, they immediately let down their defense shields. If I said I'm an ordained Baptist minister, they would turn in their seat, you know, and look out the window and put in their earbuds. But if I say I'm Catholic but not Roman, what I'm saying is I'm a part of the church Jesus started, not the one you're in. They're not the same. But they didn't realize I said that. And so they say to me, what's the difference between the Catholic Church that you say you are, which is defined in the Bible, and the Roman Catholic Church that I'm a part of, that's not described in the Bible? Well, it is, but it isn't described as the church. And so that's what I'm trying to prompt them to talk about. Now, it's too bad. Do you know how to fix this so it gets less wherever you are? Do you know how to make it little again? Because no one will be able to see my slides. Too bad. I don't know enough about this, but this is really small. I'll just read it to you if we don't know how to fix it. This is a typical Roman Catholic advertisement that's on the internet. And it says, who started your church? And this is St. Peter's Basilica. which is so recognizable. And they have churches and founders and years and locations. And they put themselves right there as the originators. Catholic Church, they actually should say Roman Catholic Church. But the Catholic Church, they're right, the church Jesus started was in AD 33, and it was in Jerusalem. But they, by putting their little St. Peter's Basilica at the top, are implying that in 2016, they are still this. But they're not, and I'll show you in just a moment. And then they go, I mean, this is a fascinating list. Saddleback Church, Rick Warren, 1982, Orange County. You know, what church are you a part of? Calvary Chapel, Chuck Smith, 1965. Harvest Christian, 72, Greg Laurie. Foursquare Gospel, Amy Simple McPherson at the Angelus Temple. Christian Science, Mary Baker, Glober, Patterson, Fry, Eddy, Boston, 1879. Jehovah's Witnesses, right there. Charles Taze Russell, Judge Russell, Pennsylvania. Salvation Army, William Booth. The Mormons, Joseph Smith, 1830. What they're doing is they're kind of lumping together everyone except for them. And this is very common. And that's why Elizabeth Elliot's brother migrated to the Roman Catholic Church. That's why many people, even evangelical-type people, have moved to the Orthodox Church because they're trying to go to the pure form of Christianity. But they're not going to the pure form of Christianity. They're just going to the external, visible manifestation of ancient Christianity, which has moved far from the scriptures, as we'll see. They end with Luther up here, Martin Luther, 1517, the Anglicans, founded by Henry VIII. He did found that church. It was a Roman Catholic church. Anglicanism was started by King Henry VIII of England. And the one thing we all remember from history, if you were listening, that you were more likely to stay alive in his court if you were a dog than one of his wives, because he had a penchant for killing them. But he did start the church so he could divorce, and because Catholics wouldn't let him. But that's where Anglicans came from. It's Roman Catholic English form. Calvinists by John Calvin, Presbyterians by John Knox, etc., etc. So that's why we need to define this. Now, basically, this is how we define it. This is a little drawing I make. It's what I say is this square is the Word of God. See, Word of God right here. It's central to everything. And here's the early church, which grew into, over the centuries, the Roman Catholic Church. And this part of the Roman Catholic Church was very biblical. Actually, it's a higher percentage of that. I would say that 95% of Roman Catholicism is biblical. It's just the other 5%. Within the other 5%, there's some deadly poison that is deadlier than anything. It's damnable poison. It's a works religion that denies the once and for all death of Jesus Christ on the cross. And that is part of Roman Catholicism. This was codified in the Council of Trent. So church history started with the early church, which morphed into the Roman Catholic Church. As time went on, we have the next iteration of the church, which was very biblical, but had some non-biblical parts, and that was the Reformation. And the Reformation, if the errors are damnable of Romanism, the errors of the Reformation would be what we would call theological drift. And you've heard me talk about this many times on Q&As, but there are things in Reformation theology that aren't in the Bible. You know that. They're never mentioned in the Bible. They're logical and they're true, but they're not biblical. And yet they become the central doctrines of Reformation theology, which is what is so fascinating, that they're not in the Bible. But there is so much. The majority of Reformation theology is very biblical. The errors in Reformation theology are not damnable. They're just logical. But they're not killers. They're just dividers. Then church history goes on, and we come to what I call the evangelical church. Now remember, the Reformation retained a lot of that covenantal, which is a real danger, that people are saved because they're in families that go to church and that the parents are members and the kids just have to be confirmed. And what happens after a few generations is you have confirmed people that are lost. See, that's what happens. That if you have a non-evangelical church, an evangelical church is you were born lost, a pagan, on your way to hell, and you need to be born again. Which, doesn't that sound very similar to Jesus? To Paul? To Peter? That's what they all preached. They all looked at crowds, to the people that thought they were in the covenant, Jews, and said, you have to be born again. And the people got angry. And they say, we don't. We're Abraham's seed. Jesus said, no, I can make Abraham's seed out of rocks. You need to repent and be born again. Well, the reformers, sadly, retained elements of Old Testament Israel. You see it with all the Sabbath observance and law observance that shows up in the Reformed faith. But another thing is that they're in the covenant, kind of like the Jews were circumcised, you get baptized as an infant. You see, infant circumcision in Judaism became infant baptism in Reformation theology. It's one of the glaring errors that Luther and Calvin and Zwingli left in their theology from Romanism. They were all Roman Catholics that came out of the church, but they dragged with them some of the baggage of the church. And so that's over here. The infant baptism and the covenantal elements are theological drift, and they're incorrect, they're unbiblical. Well, we have the evangelical church. And the evangelical church, basically, I mean, this is kind of like the just to put faces with it, it would be D.L. Moody and, you know, the missions movement and Baptist Today and Billy Graham. I mean, you know, that kind of people. They're not reformed, but they're believers. They're evangelicals, and they believe that you must call people to salvation. Well, sadly, there's a percentage, just like there's a portion of Roman Catholicism that's not biblical. See, remember, this is the Bible. Roman Catholicism built on the Bible with horrific, poisonous additions. Reformation theology built on the Bible with some theological drift and baggage. Evangelical theology built on the Bible with a lot of traditions that aren't in the Bible. There are many of them. How about Sunday school? I mean, the Baptists act like Jesus started Sunday school. He did not. The early church didn't have Sunday school until the year 1789, same time as our Constitution was ratified in America. And Robert Raikes, in England, started Sunday school. There was no Sunday school before that. And people gauge churches on whether they have Sunday school, whether they have evening services. Actually, the church started with evening services, not morning services. We've made the icon morning services. And when someone has an evening like Saturday night, we wonder, oh, man, are they doing something wrong? We are prone to a lot of personality-driven traditions, and we have to always be carefully checking what we believe against the scriptures. Did you know, the longer you talk about something, the clearer it should be if it's true. And so anytime it's hasty or anytime it becomes, you know, fighting, it's not from the Lord. The longer you look at truth, the clearer it becomes. And so it's very good to always be weeding out what the additions are. But one error that could be in evangelicalism is decisionism. You know what that is? Yeah, I already did that. I prayed that. Not saying, have you been regenerated? Have you got a new heart? I'm talking about salvation. See, with the Roman Catholics, they say if you're baptized as an infant, you're in. With the covenant theology, they say if you're baptized as an infant, you're in the covenant. Do you know what our problem is? We have gotten kind of like that by saying, if you raised your hand or followed me and prayed that prayer, you're in. It doesn't mean necessarily you're in. Because there are many that say, Lord, Lord, Matthew 7, that aren't saved. The proof is whether you have a transformation on the inside and want to, from the heart, do the will of your Father in heaven, Jesus said. So we have the tradition even of decisionism, or whatever you want to call it, that people all the time say, oh, I've done that. I say, you've done that, but what has God done? Has he given you a new heart? Has he given you a new spirit? Has he taken away your stony heart? Has he given you a heart that is responsive? Has he put his spirit within you? Do you long to do his will? Do you hate sin? Those are all the evidences of salvation, the vital signs. It's kind of like, you know how when people are on big accidents, they run around and check their pulse and for breathing, you know, and all that. What are the vital signs of salvation? One of them is that you had a beginning, because it is a new birth, but if you've just made a decision and there's been no change, then what Paul said in 2 Corinthians 13:5 is, examine yourself whether you're in the faith. Because we need to do a self-examination whether we see God at work, completely changing us from the inside out. And then you say, wow, there's another circle here. Yeah, this is what theologians call the renewal or the charismatic movement. And did you know, we have to be very cautious about that. There's some people that almost think the charismatics are like Mormons. You know, they're not saved. Yet the vast majority of the charismatic renewal movement is biblical. They just have added these excessive things, you know, an excessive emotionalism, an excessive wanting some confirmation by you know, being able to speak in tongues. You know, speaking in tongues really is supernatural. If a person is empowered by God to speak a language they never learned, and they are so articulate instantaneously in that language that they can actually communicate the gospel, that is a marvelous spiritual gift. You don't really see that anymore. You see a learned pattern, very, very few syllable, kind of a prayer language or whatever called. That's wonderful. That's a sign of having a heart for God. That's not the spiritual gift of Pentecost or of Acts 2 or even of 1 Corinthians 12 through 14. That was a speaking in a language that someone else was gifted to interpret, and it was only for a sign, Paul said, to Israel, showing that people that were not Jews were going to hear the gospel and they were going to come to Christ as it was promised in Isaiah. And so this whole notion of this excessive looking for confirmation, and look what it spawned. I mean, does anybody really want to lay claim to some of the wackos that are riding around in their jets and raising multi-million dollars and getting in trouble with the IRS and claiming to heal people that they're selective in who they heal? When Peter and Paul walked in their shadow across sick people, they got well. These people have carefully orchestrated workers in the back that weed out the people that they don't want coming on the stage for them to slay in the spirit and heal. I mean, have them go to Shriners Hospital to a completely deformed burn victim and heal them. That's the level of New Testament healing, which Paul didn't have at the end. You know that. Paul never had miraculous powers after 59 AD recorded in the Bible, and he lived for almost a decade after that. He couldn't heal his best friend and son in the faith, Timothy, and he wanted to, but he couldn't. So they're off the page with the gifts. They're off the page of the scriptures with their longing. It's almost like the Bible isn't enough and the indwelling spirit isn't enough. I want more. And that's a real dangerous thing, because if you want more, the devil will give it to you. And there are many people that speak in tongues that are not Christians. Tibetans, you know, tribal people. Satan will counterfeit anything. Whenever you get away from the Bible, whenever you're outside the box, you and I are fair game for the deceiver. And what did Jesus say is the primary thing that's going to mark the further we get to the end of the age? Deception. Deception. And so that's why doctrine does matter.